There is a level of Islamophobia that we see today that I have not seen in my lifetime. It is a level of acceptance of Islamophobia.
Rosina Ali, welcome to Settle In. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
So your new book is out now. It's called Seasons of Fury: Four Families and the Rise of Islamophobia in America. And it tells the stories of those four families, but really goes so much deeper, chronicling the rise and really the roots of the rise of Islamophobia in America. I'm just curious, what made you want to look at this topic and why right now?
When I decided to write this book, it was actually about 10 years ago. And I was looking at something completely different, which was how terror convictions were impacting Muslim families in the United States. And at the same time, what we were seeing was Donald Trump's rise on the political stage. And at the time, if you might recall, a lot of media and a lot of commentators were calling his administration the most Islamophobic in US history. And while he was saying outrageous things against Muslims, his policies actually reflected a lot of what had been done in the past, specifically after 9/11. And so I decided I wanted to write this book as a way to remember a history that we too often forget.
I mean, you mentioned 9/11, and a lot of people sort of trace back Islamophobia and think, well, that was a real turning point. That was when there was a surge of this anti-Muslim, Islamophobic rhetoric and sentiment and policies that followed as well. And before we get into the families and the incredible reporting that you share in this book, I want to ask you personally. Because, look, as someone who sort of grew up as an adult post 9/11, right? I just graduated from college in 2001, and I know what a formative time that was for so many Muslim Americans, just because of what was going on in the country and around the world. I wonder what your memories are. Where were you on 9/11? What do you remember about that day and how things changed for you?
So my memory is so different from a lot of Muslim friends I have here in the tri-state area, because I grew up in a very small town in California and I was in school. And when the attacks happened, I was still getting ready for school. And I just recall coming into the living room and just seeing my parents in complete shock and paralysis. And it really did not register to me what had happened until I got to school and everyone started talking about it and talking about what had taken place that day. And I still don't think I quite registered the impact it would have on my life or my family's life. One thing that I say to people, and I think a lot of people feel this way too, is before 9/11, I thought of myself mostly as an immigrant or as a South Asian person. And that was true of the small town I was living in. I mean, to them, I was just this, brown person from South Asia, and there weren't really many South Asians in my town. And it wasn't after until 9/11 that me being Muslim became a big deal to them and myself.
How did things change? You said you didn't quite register at the time the impact or how things would change for you and your family. How did they change? I will share one of the things I remember reporting on widely too, as I was just starting my journalism career, was how a lot of Muslim families, a lot of Arab families, a lot of South Asian families, a lot of Sikh families too, right, who were caught up in this because of a lack of understanding around the Muslim faith, they felt like they had to prove their loyalty over and over and over again. Did you experience that?
It's interesting because I think I was in this mode of feeling like I'm going to challenge my understanding of what the US is. I so held on to this belief that the United States would protect me no matter what, because this was a country founded on the belief of tolerance and freedom of speech. And it was astonishing to me how quickly my parents were afraid. Things didn't change for us in a big dramatic way, but it started happening in small ways. So, for example, when we would talk on the phone, my parents would tell me, just be careful about what you say over the phone. We were not allowed to use the words George W. Bush or OBL in at home because they were so worried about who might be listening. And in retrospect, And even then, I actually found it funny because we were not allowed to speak the name of the president of the United States, arguably the most powerful man in the country or in the world. And I think it was basically this sense that something could happen at any time. And one of the things that happened actually, which I don't really talk about, but and my father didn't talk about, was that he had a dollar store when I was growing up, and he had a dollar store at the time of 9/11. And this was a small town. He knew almost everyone in town. People knew him. And people knew him as Ali, his last name. And at one point, his store was surrounded by police officers. And he was very confused about what happened. And they came and started questioning him. And it turned out that they were looking for someone else, a completely different man who was wanted for theft. But this man's name was supposedly Ali as well. And my father was just so disappointed that the people he had known for so many years would now think that he was a suspicious man. And I think it was just shifts like that that started to reframe my understanding of what it meant to be Muslim in this country.
Do you feel like that helped inform the kind of stories that you want to tell, the kind of work you want to do over your career as well?
You know, I actually didn't necessarily want to write about Muslim stories. When I started my journalism career, I was very, very focused on the wars abroad. I was very much focused on what was happening in Afghanistan, in Pakistan, in Iraq, the expanding war on terror on the communities abroad. And it wasn't until I was living in Egypt, and this was around 2015, and I came back to the United States, and I realized that I had to contend with how the war on terror has really affected the community here, and not just the Muslim community, but the country as a whole. And I say this actually, and I'm curious, Amna, what you think too, but I've asked several Muslim friends of mine who are lawyers and journalists and even artists, and asked them if they would have done something else if 9/11 hadn't happened. And this is all to say that I think no matter what we sought out to do, 9/11 has shaped a lot of Muslim Americans and the choices they've made along the way.
I think that's 100% true. I'd say I found the same thing among a lot of folks that I know. And I've said many times before, I'll say again today, I would not be a journalist today if it weren't for that day. But you do such a magnificent job in the book, linking, as you're talking about there, what we were seeing unfolding abroad, this global war on terror that was very quickly launched and quickly spread over the years too, and to the wars at home, as you phrase it. But you also do something we haven't seen before, which is you go way back in history, way pre 9/11, and you talk about what has unfolded in this country for generations, the roots that were set years ago. So I want to talk about one of the stories that you profile, which is the story of Abdin Jabara. He's born in 1940 in the U.S. to immigrants from what was then known as Greater Syria. Tell us about him. Why is his story important?
So Abedin is an incredible person. He was born in 1940, as you said, in a small town in Michigan. So his trajectory is fascinating because his father was a staunch Republican, fought in the U.S. Army during World War I, and was extremely patriotic. And Abedin was actually quite political and became quite a leftist. And this was because of, one, he really wanted to understand his parents' legacy and where they came from. But two, the 1967 Israel-Arab War really affected his life and really changed how he thought about his place in the United States and what he wanted to do. And one thing he really wanted to do was bring Palestine and the issue of Palestinian freedom to the U.S. public and bring it front and center in political conversation in America. And Abedin was Muslim, not particularly practicing. He became one of the first Arab American to be surveilled by the U.S. government after 1967, and became the first U.S. citizen to be monitored by the National Security Agency. And really what we see through Abedin's story is this expansion of the surveillance state that has targeted Muslims long before 9/11. But, you know, one other thing that I really appreciated about Abedin's story, which is what I wanted to do in this book, is also show that a lot of these Muslim families and Muslim Americans in general have very different relationships with religion and faith. And his was so different from the other people I spoke about. He hardly went to mosque, and yet he recognized himself as being monitored, not just as an Arab, but as a Muslim as well.
So back it up a little bit for us. How and why does he come to be the subject of that kind of government surveillance? And what does that look like? How does that show up in his day-to-day life?
So Abedin was very, very politically active. He not only worked for a very leftist organization that was challenging the government's surveillance program against, basically he was challenging COINTELPRO, but he was also, you know, speaking at forums about Palestine, speaking at public rallies. He was a lawyer who was defending a lot of Arab Americans, especially around Dearborn and Detroit. And he was just extremely vocal. The other thing he was doing was he was part of the National Lawyers Guild, which was a progressive network of lawyers, and taking trips to the Middle East to basically meet with Palestinian prisoners, to meet with activists. And he also ended up meeting with Yasser Arafat at some point. And what he was doing was speaking about a politics that didn't quite align with the U.S. government's position at that point with regards to Israel and Palestine. And I think that not only spooked the government, but made them very suspicious about what Abedin and his friends were doing. I will say Abedin was not guilty or actually charged with any sort of crime.
You mentioned he's a lawyer, and you write about how he goes on to establish the American Arab Anti-Discrimination Committee. What is that work like? Who is he representing in that work?
Yes. So the 70s and 80s is a really fascinating time in Arab America and Muslim America in general. And what this organization was doing was basically trying to protect the civil rights of Arab Americans. And what's so significant about this organization is that, you know, as Abedin's early life shows and his father's life shows, Arab Americans were able to meld into American society pretty well. They were able to assimilate, especially because they can appear white. But by the 70s and 80s, Arab Americans were being recognized as a distinct group. And what that also meant was that they were being harassed. And during the 80s, there was actually basically a crisscrossing, astonishing array of hate crimes happening against Arab Americans. There were not just, verbal harassment, but also quite violent. There was firebombing of places of Arab organizations, assassinations of people, including Alex Odeh, who was part of the ADC. And there was also just bloody violence happening on the streets against Arab Americans for their Palestinian support, but also for what people were considering. This was also the rise of Gulf money coming to the United States. And I think there was also a reaction to that. But all to say that basically by the 80s, there was a need for something like the ADC that was going to try to protect the civil rights of Arab Americans.
So by the 1980s, you have this sort of growing Arab American population that's increasingly catching the attention of, being targeted by the authorities. In the 90s in America, we have to remember there was such a cultural shift here, right? There was this global shift in threats away from all the Cold War focus on more complex global international networks, and that included extremist Islamic groups, right? So tell us about what you saw in terms of tactics by the government, by the FBI in particular, as they're working to dismantle some of these groups. How did that change the relationship between the government and federal authorities and this Arab American and also American population?
So I should say that when I started reporting this book, I actually thought I was going to start after 9/11. or at 9/11, because I thought I was going to retrace the history of 9/11 and after. But the more I pulled the thread, I realized that there had been widespread surveillance and targeting of Muslims even before 9/11, and I had to understand why that was. One of the threads that explains why there has been such interest in the Muslim American community has to do with U.S. foreign policy. In the 70s and 80s, there was a specific U.S. foreign policy towards Israel and Palestine that recognized Palestinian militant groups and recognized them as militant groups that had political aims. What was happening in the 90s was a rise of political Islam around the world. And the U.S. also started shifting its focus towards political Islam. And this was not by accident. What's fascinating is that in the 80s, while the United States was very suspicious of certain militant groups, especially in Palestine, they were backing, for example, the Mujahideen in Afghanistan, which eventually became Taliban. They were backing it so much so that they allowed Mujahideen representatives to fundraise on Atlantic Avenue in Brooklyn. What we saw in the 80s was basically the United States struggling to determine and define what its foreign policy was towards the Muslim world. And the Reagan administration, it's worth noting, actually believed that Islam could be a very useful tool in the fight against communism, hence their support for the Mujahideen in Afghanistan. And what they recognized in Palestine are militant groups that were not just Islamic, but also, you know, secular. Those distinctions started to fade in the late 80s, specifically because the Soviet Union fell. Communism was no longer a world threat, but what did become a worldwide threat, according to the United States government, was political Islam and the rise of Islamic terrorism, which is why by the 90s, in an effort to clamp down on such terrorism, the U.S. actually surveilled Muslim communities all across the United States in one of the biggest surveillance programs in U.S. history.
So at the time, as the U.S. is shifting its focus, it no longer needs to support some of these groups like the Mujahideen in its fight against communism. The Soviet Union is gone, and it's shifting to look at political Islam and its rise as much more of a threat. How does that show up here in the United States? What does that surveillance, as you document in the book, what does it look like on the ground?
It's pretty chilling. I mean, it's so blatant that people who are living in certain communities, for example, the Bridgeview community outside of Chicago, they saw unmarked vans outside their homes. And they would see them for days and days and weeks, and they started noticing maybe there's something going on. Something seems to be amiss. Why is there an unmarked van here? They also started noticing people coming to their door, inquiring, asking questions. A lot of people in these communities believed that their phones were tapped. To someone on the ground who doesn't actually know what's happening, that might sound like paranoia. That might actually sound quite absurd. You know, people are hearing things on their phone. They're seeing strangers outside their house. But once the information actually came out about the extent of this surveillance program, it was actually worse than probably one person could have imagined. It was astonishing, actually. FBI, while working with local police departments, not only went to outside people's houses, they followed people to emergency rooms at the hospital. They showed up at mosques and looked at license plate numbers, trying to figure out who was parked and who was attending the mosque. They went to Muslim Student Association meetings and took notes of what was happening. And this was also during a time when the Muslim community in the United States was becoming more significant, in the sense that they actually wanted to build a social political presence And we saw the expansion or the founding of organizations like the Islamic Society of North America and CARE, the Council for American Islamic Relations. Some of these groups actually got together and put together a directory of Islamic institutions, bookstores, mosques for the Muslim community. And the FBI actually used that directory in order to determine what their targets were and who their target should be. There have been tens of thousands of pages amassed from these, from the surveillance program, which was called Operation Vulgar Betrayal. And there was no criminal wrongdoing found.
I'm sorry, the operation was called Vulgar Betrayal?
Yes. Quite aptly named.
Do you understand the roots of that?
It's a really good question. I actually do not. I don't.
Okay. So fast forward now to 2001 and this moment that is forever seared, I think, in our national memory, where in his joint address to Congress, just days after those horrific 9/11 attacks, you have President George W. Bush stand up and deliver this now infamous line when he's speaking to nations around the world. And he says, either you are with us or you are with the terrorists. And that draws just about as bright a line as could be articulated by an American president. What is the impact of that here at home? How does that resonate?
It's immediate. There were a lot of things happening. One was not only the U.S. government, but the media and also people on the ground were starting to pay attention to who was 100% behind America and who was questioning what happened. But what that meant, too, is that the space for any sort of discussion about U.S. foreign policy up until then contracted considerably. So what we were having after 9/11 was a sense of there are only some things you could speak about and some things you can't. So when my parents told me, don't speak about George W. Bush at home, they weren't entirely wrong. And this was something that I found over and over again while I was reporting, was that a lot of Muslim families had the same reaction in the sense that they knew that what they were saying or what they might say could be construed as not being patriotic enough and might get them into trouble. And one thing that really astonished me was just how this lust for revenge kind of captured the nation. And to one extent, we know there were, you know, hate crimes happening. Immediately after 9/11, there were attacks on Muslims or people who were thought to be Muslims, specifically brown men. The other thing that was happening, too, was that a lot of people on the ground were suspicious of their neighbors or their community members or their colleagues and actually called the FBI because they wanted the FBI to investigate their acquaintance. And this is something that we see in wartime, right? The sense of suspicion, the sense of turning your neighbor in to the authorities. But this happened over and over again to the point where the FBI, which had set up a hotline for tips, was getting calls around the clock. But it's also worth noting what was happening to Muslim communities on the ground at that point, which was not only were they terrified that an attack had happened on their homeland, they were also terrified about what their neighbors or their colleagues were thinking of them or how they were listening. They were worried about the U.S. government surveilling them. There was also the added fear of what the U.S. government would do. And one of the things it was doing was using its immigration arm to target Muslim immigrants. And so immediately what we saw were U.S. authorities picking up mostly men from their streets, from their homes, from their workplaces, and throwing them into detention, sometimes into jail, sometimes into immigration detention, without any charge. And a lot of these men, they would show up and they would have no idea what was happening, why they were there, how long they would be there for. They were given no information. And it was basically a time of double terror for the Muslim community living in the United States.
I recall so vividly hearing in our community stories of all of these kinds of things happening, right? And I remember so vividly so many people and so many families we knew who'd been here for generations, in some cases, immediately hanging an American flag outside their home, right, to try to signal, like, we are good Americans. We are not the ones you have to worry about. Talk to me about how all of this resonated across other families. You mentioned your parents not wanting you to mention the president's name or the name of Osama bin Laden or anything political in the house for fear that your phones might be tapped. I mean, was that fear, was that really, really deep in the community, or do you feel like your family was an outlier?
I thought my family was an outlier when I was young. And when I started reporting this, I realized they hardly were at all. Almost every Muslim family I spoke with had the same response. I mean, you know, this refrain, the walls have ears, was so common that I heard it in almost every interview I did. Now, the extent of how deep that fear in does differ. And what I mean to say is, one, that was an immediate response, the walls have ears. Another immediate response to your point was everyone buying American flags, or if they could not buy American flags, I mentioned one of the families, they couldn't find an American flag because they were all sold out. So they immediately bought a red, white, and blue Beanie Baby. But what's so fascinating to me was I was doing a lot of these interviews about, you know, 17, 18, 19 years after 9/11. There were some families who still would not talk about that time because they were still afraid about of what the U.S. government might do, who might be listening, that they might get in trouble. There was also a trauma response. They were just so, they did not want to recall that time because it was just so difficult for them. And this, I was actually quite surprised by the number of families who would not speak with me.
I mean, when you do really sit with it and remember what it felt like immediately after the attack, I think it's fair to say people were so terrified, terrified to know that something like that could happen on American soil, terrified that it might happen again. And in this campaign of going around, as you say, and just picking up men, you know, young boy or teenagers, men, just to question them, just to see what they might know, where were they ending up? I mean, how did it, it's largely NYPD and DOJ and other forces. How did they justify it at the time? And what happened to a lot of those men and boys?
So this was all justified through the lens of prevention, which is completely understandable. We had gone through the biggest terrorist attack on our homeland. Everyone was understandably afraid. And the U.S. government decided in order to stop another attack, they would focus on prevention, which meant stopping the bad guys before they could do anything. Now, the problem was we didn't always know who the bad guys were, which meant a lot of people were getting swept up in this dragnet. And there were basically a few things that happened in the immediate years after 9/11, and each kind of explains the way in which the government's response started firming up. So in the immediate weeks and months after 9/11, we had the mass arrests. They were haphazard. People were getting arrested, as I mentioned, off the street and from their homes. And they didn't have any criminal charge against them. But what they did have was perhaps a pending visa application, perhaps an expired visa, perhaps they had not put in their asylum application in time. So what we saw happening was, in some cases, people being kept in immigration detention for months and years only to be deported. One of the families I mentioned in the book, that happened to them. This family had come to the United States, had built a life in the United States, where actually had just bought a home, their first home, in 2000. And the parents had four children who all went to school. And the father was actually picked up and arrested on suspicion. He was actually kept in jail, in prison. And he was kept there for over a year. And he had no idea what the actual charge was. No one actually gave him a formal charge. But he was eventually deported, as were a lot of other men who were swept up in this way. What happened by 2003 was the United States government, the Bush administration, refined its tactic and implemented what was called the National Security Entry Exit Registration System, NSEERS program, which called for boys and men from about 16 Muslim majority countries to register in a government registry. If you think about it, that's astonishing. The US government in 2003 was calling on people of different nationalities to show up at immigration centers to register with them. And so what you would see if you were walking down the street and paying attention were long lines of men from Pakistan, men from Sudan, men from Egypt who had to line up and register with the government. Unfortunately, what happened is about 80,000 people registered. Tens of thousands of those were deported. And it was not because they had actually been charged with a crime or even convicted of a crime. It's because, again, it was because their visa expired or there were some immigration issues, but it allowed the U.S. government to deport these men. This was part of what the U.S. government was thinking was their war on terror. But what is really astonishing is that by 2005, the government expanded and really institutionalized the war on terror in permanent ways, in lasting ways. Not only did it create the Department of Homeland Security, which had under its wing the DOJ, the FBI, and so forth, it also created what we now consider what we call ICE. And ICE became a very useful tool in basically trying to capture what the U.S. considered aggressive or suspicious immigrants, but also became very, very aggressive in immigration enforcement in general.
As part of this prevention effort launched by the U.S. government to try and make sure that another similar attack never happens again, they employ a lot of different tactics. And you profile one of those in the story of a young man named Matin Siraj. He is about 20 or 21 years old at the time, living in the New York area. He meets an older man named Osama El Dawoodi in 2003, and they establish a sort of father-son bond. Tell me about why his story matters. Why did you include that?
So Matin's story really captures what was happening in the justice system around this time, and the shifts in the justice system. And I don't mean just the courts, but also the way that law enforcement was carrying out its duties. And one of the things that law enforcement was doing pretty widely after 9/11 was using informants to go into communities and surveil people and monitor people. Now, this is not new. This tactic has been used before. For example, when the U.S. government or the FBI was trying to capture mob bosses or mafia members or gang members or drug cartels. But the difference between those examples and what happened to Matin is that often the U.S. government had someone who had a connection to one of those organizations or one of those rings, who they could cultivate as an informant. Matin was not part of any organization. He was not part of a terrorist group or a sleeper cell. The only reason, the only thing that actually Osama al-Dawoodi and Matin had in common was that they were both Muslim, which is why the FBI and the NYPD sent Osama to speak with Matin. And, you know, I don't want to say that Matin did nothing wrong. He said pretty nefarious things. He was really upset about U.S. foreign policy, and he was very critical of the U.S. government, both what it was doing abroad and what it was doing in the United States. And he was talking openly about it on the streets, but he didn't actually perpetrate any violence. And what Osama al-Dawoodi did through his NYPD handler was goad Matin into a plot to blow up Herald Square. There was no evidence that they actually had any weapons. There were no plans for a day or a time for the attack. Mateen did, for Osama, scope out Herald Square and kind of draw some plans. And he did say at one point, you know, yes, I will be part of it. I will do it. And actually, he did offer blowing up Herald Square as the idea. But he also tried to back out of the plan multiple times. And then the NYPD arrested him. His trial is astonishing because he was arrested. He was sent to jail immediately, was not able to be out on bail. And he faced life in prison. And he wanted to get his day in court. He wanted justice. And he wanted to show that he was not a terrorist. So he insisted, even as the U.S. government kept offering him a plea deal with at one point 10 years in prison, he insisted, no, I want my day in court. I want to show that I'm not a terrorist. I said some terrible things, but I don't want violence. The trial played out and it lasted a month. And it really showed, astonishingly, what the courts were allowing the United States government to bring in as evidence and what it was disallowing the defense to bring in as evidence. And there was a discrepancy in the court during that month about what narratives we were allowed to showcase and what narratives the jury would understand. And mind you, at that time, when his trial was happening, it was 2006. And people were still very, very afraid of the names Al-Qaeda or Hamas or Sharia or terrorism. And those words kept coming up over and over and over again in the trial. Eventually, Mateen was convicted. And he was sentenced, because he was convicted of terrorism, he was sentenced to 30 years in prison. And I think one of the most heartbreaking details about that entire case, including which, you know, Mateen still talks about today, is that some of the jurors in the case weren't even sure if he would have actually done anything. They weren't convinced that he was a cold-blooded terrorist killer, but they were so afraid of another terrorist attack happening that they did not want to be the ones to let free a potential terrorist.
I mean, how common was what happened to Mateen? In the years since, do we have facts and figures and broader data to show how broadly this kind of tactic was applied?
Scholars have done an incredible amount of work on this. And what we've seen is that there are about almost 1,000 Muslims who were swept up on terrorism charges after 9/11, and more than half of them were actually not convicted of violence, or in the sense that they didn't actually perpetrate any violence, nor were they part of a group that was going to perpetrate violence. They were not part of Al-Qaeda or another militant Islamist terrorist group. And what we saw were a lot of young men, or, you know, young or middle-aged men being swept up. They were individuals, they were community leaders, and it was so easy to actually convict them because a lot of them were charged by what is called material support for terrorism. And this statute was actually written in the mid-90s, but used so widely after 9/11 by prosecutors against suspects, against Muslim suspects in particular. And the problem with material support is that it is so vague and it is not actually very well defined, that material support for terrorism could mean anything. It could mean translating magazines that belong to a foreign terrorist organization. It could mean, offering an informant, an undercover informant, help or taking money from an undercover informant for nefarious purposes. It could mean storing rain jackets in your closet. all of these are actual cases in which people have been convicted on material support laws and then be sent away to prison for years and years, decades even. And one of the more chilling aspects of the War on Terror convictions is scholars have also found that the use of entrapment happened so often in these cases, the use of informants that goaded people into plots, which the U.S. government recognizes as entrapment. Entrapment happened so often in these cases, but it was very, very difficult to prove in terrorism cases as compared to other cases in which entrapment has been used. And I think a part of that has to do with the narrative we built after 9/11, that anything revolving around Muslims and Islamic terrorism immediately meant guilt.
So in the years after 9/11, you have this mass surveillance of Muslim Americans, Arab Americans, and others. You have deportations. You've got a registry, which is a landmark moment in American history in terms of a certain group of a certain faith being asked to register with the federal government. And you have all these men and being picked up and arrested. The suspicion, the mistrust has been growing between the government and this community. And then you have President Obama come into office and you have him deliver this speech in Cairo in 2009, in which he explicitly says there's going to be a new beginning between Muslims and the U.S. He says there'll be a relationship based on mutual interest, mutual respect, one based on the truth that America and Islam are not exclusive and need not be in competition. Was there a new relationship? I mean, from the families you talked to, did they see a change?
They wanted to see a change. When President Obama came into office, several of the families I spoke to really, really believed that it would mark a different trajectory for Muslims in the U.S. And I think what they hoped for was a reckoning and some justice. And I will say that Obama's rhetoric was a marked difference from his predecessor. But when it came to the very structures and institutions that were targeting Muslims, those remained the same and in some ways actually expanded. So, for example, in the United States, ICE and DHS continued to expand and their tactics became more aggressive. Terrorism prosecutions under the DOJ actually rose when Obama came to office. At the same time, the FBI and police departments were continuing on the sense of we need to surveil Muslim communities, but also we need to think about what radicalizes Muslims. That narrative and that approach to the Muslim community became even more entrenched under the Obama administration. There was really no market shift. And this was something that I heard not just from Muslim families that I interviewed, but also former government officials. Actually, several of them told me that they really didn't see a difference between the Bush administration and the Obama administration when it came to fighting terrorism. I do want to add one thing, and I think this gets lost quite a bit sometimes when we think about Muslim Americans, is that Muslim Americans are part of this country that does impact much of the world. And a lot of U.S. foreign policy has affected the very communities that a lot of Muslims in the U.S. come from. What we saw under the Obama administration was not just continuing the war on terror abroad, but expanding it to places like Pakistan and Somalia and Yemen. And that actually impacted a lot of the communities living in the United States who still had family and relatives over there. And I think that continues to build a sense of distrust and isolation among this community when foreign policy discussions, again, are just not allowed to happen in a way that's not just nuanced, but layered.
I'm curious, among the officials you talk to, How do they look back on this time? I mean, there was such a sense of doing whatever it takes to make sure that nothing like this ever happens again, that there's not another 9/11. Do they look back on any of the decisions made, the policies implemented, the mass arrests, the calling in for questioning, the registries? Do they look back on any of that as mistakes?
I was actually surprised to find that for the most part, no. There were several senior government officials I spoke to, a couple of whom didn't quite remember the details of, for example, the NCR's registry. And mind you, this was a registry that broke the lives of tens of thousands of families. But it is something that U.S. officials who were part of those that decision-making process, that is not something that they dwell on or really remember in much detail. And then I spoke with some former officials, and it's prosecutors and administration officials, who remembered this time as unfortunate but necessary. They don't disagree or think that the prevention strategy was flawed. They do recognize that Muslim civil liberties may have been violated, but they believe that it was a necessary cost. And it is that is an aspect of this entire story that has astonished me too, because I think there really hasn't been a reckoning in this country of just how much the post 9/11 years affected the Muslim American community.
What about the role of the media in all of this? I mean, how the wars were covered, how government policy was covered, what words and phrases are used with regards to some people and not with others. How do you, in your book, examine the role of mainstream media at that time?
Mainstream media actually played a very significant role in solidifying a certain narrative of the war on terror, very much solidifying the Bush, President Bush's statement, "You're either with us or against us." So what we saw happening after 9/11 was a lot of media organizations and commentators trying to understand what had happened by trying to understand Islam. There were a lot of explainers from, you know, from mainstream organizations like The Guardian to even MTV that were publishing explainers on what Islam is for an American audience. But what the U.S. media was not doing as much was really trying to contend with what did it mean to launch a war on terror. They weren't really treating the Bush administration's war as a policy choice, but rather as an inevitable thing that exists in the world. It's as if it was fated. It really constrained our ability to think about what it did it mean to fight a war on terror when the word terror and terrorism was not very well defined. It was not a war on Al-Qaeda that the U.S. government launched. It was a war on terror, and that could mean anything. Terrorism is a concept. It's a tactic. But because it was so ambiguous, it actually allowed the U.S. government and the U.S. public and the U.S. media to continue to define it in very nefarious terms in which anyone could impute meaning. And so what happened after, in the months after 9/11, was a lot of media would interview someone called experts of Islam, scholars of Islam. But a lot of these people were actually, unfortunately, turned out to be what we would call today Islamophobes. They were warning about the teachings of the Quran. They were warning about the teachings of the religion. And there's this really fascinating study that a sociologist did recently about the way in which media had covered the war on terror. And what he found was there were a lot of Muslim American community leaders who were brought onto the air to give interviews and talk about the Muslim community. But as soon as they started talking about U.S. foreign policy or started thinking about the war on terror as in foreign policy terms, they were quickly denounced or they didn't get enough airtime. And instead, what we saw was a lot of other voices eclipsing the Muslim community's voices. We saw voices who were warning about what Islam teaches. And again, the narrative became about political Islam versus the West, rather than about the war on terror as a foreign policy decision. And ultimately, that gave rise to the narrative that the Bush administration said it wanted to prevent, which was a clash of civilizations narrative.
We should underscore here, your book is subtitled The Rise of Islamophobia in America. We've been talking a lot about government policies and tactics, but how did all of that show up in terms of what everyday Muslim Americans lived through? Like, was there even tracking of anti-Muslim Islamophobic attacks over all these years?
I think a part of the problem with even thinking about Islamophobia is that there hasn't been a very good accounting of what that means. Now, Islamophobia is not just a reaction to, let's say, a terror attack and people being afraid or ignorant of Muslims. What I was really curious about when I decided to embark on this project was understand why is Islamophobia so bad that the U.S. government is willing to, 15, 16 years after 9/11, the U.S. public is willing to elect a man who says that he wants to ban all Muslims. I wanted to understand why Islamophobia had become not just prevalent, but accepted in the United States. And one of the things I found was that Islamophobia is not just, again, a reaction, but rather it is manufactured. It is manufactured in this country through anti-Muslim hate groups, through a lot of, you know, millions of dollars of funding that was poured into the war on terror effort, but that became used for anti-Muslim efforts. It was poured into groups like Center for Security Policy that was honestly used multiple times and was a friend of the U.S. government for many years, but eventually led movements on the ground against mosques, against new Islamic institutions being opened around the country. And what we saw was Islamophobia reaching the streets to a level we had never seen before. You may recall in 2009, 2010, there was a nationwide debate about the Ground Zero Mosque, which was meant to be an Islamic community center that was going to be started and founded in Lower Manhattan, and it happened to be a few blocks away from the Ground Zero site. A lot of the reaction to it and the debate around it was manufactured, and it was really spearheaded by anti-Muslim hate groups that were getting funding around that time through philanthropists, through donors, but also sometimes through U.S. government-aligned organizations. And what we saw was those same talking points be regurgitated over and over again that were used against the Ground Zero Mosque. They were now used in small towns in New Jersey, as I mentioned in the book, or in Tennessee, or in Chicago, or elsewhere across the country. And these talking points really centered on the notion that Islam was just too different from Western civilization, and Muslims were actually dangerous. They would not keep a community safe. In fact, they were a danger to a community safety because terrorists were growing they were actually living in the midst of Muslim communities, which is unfortunately not so distant from what law enforcement had been saying for so many years after 9/11.
So, Prasina, you've taken such a long look through history to get us to this moment where we are today. So I'm curious how you look at America today contextually on this, because, yes, on the one hand, you have the kind of commonplace anti-Muslim rhetoric that you see from the president of the United States, from some of his closest advisors, from sitting members of Congress. But then you also have Muslim Americans who've risen to very powerful positions. They've been elected to Congress, people like Ilhan Omar, Rashida Tlaib. You've got the first Muslim mayor in New York City. You have another candidate for the Senate in Michigan. How do you look at the context of where we are today and what it means for this?
it is remarkable, the rise of Muslim politicians in this country, but I also think it was inevitable, only because Muslims are a growing population in the country. That said, they're still about just 1.5% of the American population. But what is different since 9/11 is, one, they are a lot more Muslims have protection in the sense that they were either born here or they were naturalized. Unlike Muslims who were mostly immigrants after 9/11, a lot of the Muslims we see today who are rising up in political circles do have a sense of security. But what has also happened after in the last 25 years is a cohering of a political Muslim voice that in a sense is a reaction, ironically, to 9/11. Before 9/11, there were disparate Muslim voices, but mostly people really considered themselves, again, South Asian or immigrant or so forth. But 9/11 really started cohering a Muslim social political identity. And so when we see the rise of people like Zohran Mamdani or Abdullah Sayyid or Rashida Tlaib or Ilhan Omar, they do talk about themselves as being Muslim. That said, there is a level of Islamophobia that we see today that I have not seen in my lifetime. It is a level of acceptance of Islamophobia. The ways in which senior officials, policymakers, Laura Loomer, for example, the advisor to the president, speaking about Muslims and Islam as if they are second-class citizens, calling for a complete ban on Muslims, calling for a complete ban on anything that is related to Islam in the United States. And to me, what that says is not so much about the Muslim American community, it says a lot more about the American community as a whole.
What because do you mean by that?
I think what we've done is we've reached a point where, you know, tolerance of religion and freedom of religion was a founding tenet of this country. And what we see now is a society that is actually okay with dismantling that very pillar of the United States. We are now openly calling for Islam not to be part of the United States or part of its social and political fabric. And I think what we're doing is actually changing ourselves as a society in really damning and worrying ways. This is not a problem just for the Muslim community. It's actually a problem for American society as a whole. And it's changing the face of what we think of as the values of American society.
You set out to ask some pretty big questions in this book. Do you feel like you got answers to what you were looking for?
I got answers, but not solutions.
Do you see any place those solutions might come in the near or far future?
I do. We were talking about the media earlier, and I see the way in which a lot of attacks against Abdullah Sayyid and Zohran Mamdani have been covered. And I think we could do a lot better in offering a long view of what Islamophobia is and why these Islamophobic attacks exist. One thing that is astounding is that Islamophobia rises in the U.S. not necessarily after a terrorist attack, but around election season. And Islamophobia is becoming a feature of U.S. politics. And I think we could do a lot more as a society, as media, or as policymakers, or as senior leaders to challenge that wherever we see it.
Rosina Ali, the book is Seasons of Fury, Four Families and the Rise of Islamophobia in America. It's been such a pleasure to speak with you. Thank you so much for making the time.
Thank you so much for having me.